And you're listening to KBOO Portland. That was a little Pink Floyd there. Anyway, coming up next we have Larry Kirwan, a musician with the band Black 47, author of 5 books and 15 plays. He talks about his career, about his latest project, the Broadway-bound musical set during the Civil War draft riots, Paradise Square.
Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Larry Kirwan, who is the author of 5 books, including A History of Irish Music, Rock in the Bronx, a memoir titled Green Suede Shoes, a collection of plays, Mad Angels, and Liverpool Fantasy, a novel. He is also the founder, guitarist, and lead vocalist of the legendary New York Irish-American political band Black 47. His latest project is a musical, Paradise Square, which is playing at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley with an eye toward Broadway. We start by talking about Paradise Square, then move on to his career as an author and musician.
Larry Kirwan, you're a composer, and yet most of this music derives from Stephen Foster. It's set in 1863 in the Five Points area of New York, of Manhattan, and it concerns draft riots for the Civil War. So this is a kind of interesting area for a man who has focused mostly on the Irish, even though there were a lot of Irish there. I mean, this is a new area for you, I guess. What brought you
Not in the least. You know, really? One of the problems with America is that everybody feels they got to put you in a particular bag. You know, whereas where I come from, you just delve into everything. So let me give you the full story of it. I grew up in a town called Wexford in the southeast corner of Ireland.
Colm Tobin came from there.
Colm's from there, yeah. So I was raised by an old grandfather who told me stories every night. And one of the stories he used to tell me was about the Five Points. Even though he'd never been there, it was so strong in immigrant lore that he knew about it and used to tell me about it.
Where exactly is the Five Points?
It's in Lower Manhattan, roughly now around the bottom of Chinatown, although a lot of it is built up with the courthouses down there.
So it's the far end, sort of on the East River side of where the World Trade Center is on the west.
Right, roughly across from that. I also, like everyone in Ireland, knew the music of Stephen Foster, which fascinates Americans, but Stephen Foster was known around the world. Although I love the sense of loss in his songs, there was a kind of a Victorian calcification that was laid down on top of all of them. The arrangements were from that era. When I was about 16, 17, I got a gig playing guitar in the rough working men's bars of the quayside, the docks in Wexford. Part of your gig was to back whoever wanted to come up on stage and sing with you. And they would usually do that with, you know, 5 or 6 pints aboard. And many of them sang Stephen Foster's songs. And for the first time, I heard the essence of Foster, because they didn't care about the Victorian calcification. They were singing these songs from the heart. And I got all the loss of the Foster songs. And then I immigrated and moved to New York City, and I was living in the East Village, which was just above the Five Points. So I used to go down there. And I was always interested in history. So I spent a lot of time in the used bookstores in New York. And one day I came upon a book that had some etchings of the African-American-owned dance halls in the Five Points. And I knew that the Irish musicians and the African-American musicians got together in these dance halls. I always wondered, because eventually I'd formed Black 47, which used Irish and African roots. But I was always wondering, how did they mix? What did they do? And then I saw the bands in these etchings, and it was always mixed race. It was Irish fiddle player, Irish singer, African-American banjo player, an African-American percussion player.
This was when you were in your 20s.
Yeah. But then I began to look at the faces of the dancers in the etchings, and it was always an African-American man and an Irish woman. And the joy and the delight in their faces beamed across the centuries to me. So I began to do more research on that and found out that between 1845 and 1863, many Irish women married African Americans, and they were called amalgamationists, not by themselves, but by the uptown people who really hated this idea of the two peoples getting together, not the least of which was the babies would be brown, but they would also be Catholic because of the Irish coming in. And that was a horrific thing for the uptown Protestants, as they were called, the ruling class. So, you know, all these things came together, and around 2009, I'd written about 14 plays at that point, and I was looking for something new that would take in all the different things I'd learned about this, but also my own particular talents as a playwright and as a composer, as you say, and a lyricist. And I put it all together, and 2012, we put it on a place called The Cell, run by a woman called Nancy Manachurian on 23rd Street in New York, and it became a big success.
And that was called Paradise Square?
No, it was called Hard Times at that point. And it got a really good review in the New York Times. And then Stephen Foster's, the anniversary, the 150th anniversary of his death was January 14, 2014, and we put it on again. And a guy called Peter LeDon, who is a producer, showed up. He thought it was great, and he introduced me to a producer called Gart Trubinsky,
who's got quite a negative reputation from years ago.
Yeah, except not with me, because it was the passion he showed for it. After he'd heard it and read it, he said, I've done two big musicals of a certain type.
Ragtime.
Ragtime and Showboat. I want this, want to work on this to make it the trilogy. I was thinking, wow, really? So, you know, he had this passion for it, and he persuaded me that this is something we could do, and they bring in other people into it, and he brought in a great creative team, and here we are in Berkeley Rep.
Larry Kerwin, when you were doing it as Hard Times, that was the music of Stephen Foster.
Yeah, I put in some songs to, you know, bridge the story gap. I was using about 15 Foster songs and probably did three or four of my own. I was telling the story about this African-American woman, because she was, I always thought she should be the center of the play, the saloon owner, Nellie, and the two boys, an Irish guy who escapes the famine in Ireland and an African-American boy who escapes slavery.
Is that still the basic element of... So the main characters are a saloon keeper and a black kid and a white kid.
Yeah, they're roughly the main characters. I added some more characters to that. I think there's about nine of the original characters I worked with still in the play.
Is Stephen Foster still in it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, very much so.
So at what point did Marcus Gardley and Craig Lucas come in?
Craig came in about 4 years ago, and then Craig left after a couple of years, and Marcus came in 2 years, 18 months ago, something like that. I'm not sure the exact dates.
And you worked with them to try to smooth out the rough edges?
Well, Marcus is a poet, and he's also African-American, and he's a fine writer of white characters, too, but we wanted to get the authentic feel of African-American people in there, and who better than Marcus?
Where did Nathan Tyson come in as an additional lyricist?
Nathan came in around the same time as Craig, and Jason Howland, a really important part of the team as a musician and arranger and composer, came in at that point too. Bill T. Jones, the choreographer, came in at that point. And Moises Kaufman. So they all kind of arrived roughly the same time. Yeah.
These are very, very big names in New York.
Very big anywhere. What struck me about all of them wasn't so much the big name part of it. You get over that in an afternoon. But it's the fact that they all wanted to really work on it, that they saw that there was a power to it and really wanted to add their talents to it. And that's what impressed me more than just the name. And they all have. It's no longer just my project. I had to seed a lot of what I would normally do. But that's cool. You know, I have plenty of other plays and projects to go with. So it's been exciting, you know, and not without its problems, as one could imagine. But we're all still talking. We go out drinking together. So that's a good part of it.
As you were creating this, what made you decide to use 1863, which is the time of the draft riots?
Because I'm a dramatist, and you always look for a time that you're pushing against time. It's one of the things with drama and with character. What happens to characters when there's an event coming down the pike? The draft riots have been kind of written out of American history because they don't really follow the American narrative that the people rose up against the awful conditions they were working in. The draft actually set it off, but many, many immigrants were really displeased. They'd come to America for the new life, and here they were living even worse in many cases than they had been in the countries they came from, and they were sick of that. So there was a kind of a mass uprising on July 13th, 1863, that went on for 4 days and had some really bad things that happened too. But the beginning of it was good, was that we're not going to take it anymore.
So that's the point where the play starts then, I guess.
Yes. Well, the play starts with the Irish regiment, the Fighting 69th, leaving New York. Many of them are regulars in Nellie's saloon. And they go off with full hopes of what they're doing. But with many of the Irish and the other immigrant columns that went off, they were put to the front lines and used as cannon fodder. And there was a resistance against that. And then Mr. Lincoln brought in the draft. And it wasn't so much that they were against the draft even. It's just that if you had $300, you could buy yourself out of it. And $300 was a year's wages for a man or a woman at that point. So there was uproar over that.
Martin Scorsese's film Gangs of New York, is that before this all happened?
I think it's roughly the same time, but I saw the movie, but I don't remember the actual. I must look it up and find out that it is the draft riots, but I have read part of the book, The Gangs of New York, and that was about the Irish gangs fighting the nativist know-nothing gangs.
That's sort of the era and the place.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely the era and the place. Yeah.
Which kind of gives people an idea of exactly what we're looking at from a different perspective now.
Yeah, from a very different perspective. And I don't think, to my memory, there were many African-Americans involved in that. It was more the Irish gangs against the American Bowery Boy gangs, as far as I remember.
Larry Kerwin, let's talk a little about your career. So you're born in Wexford. I guess you didn't know Colm Tóibín until years later, or did you?
No, I met him in New York. But Colm actually is from a different town in Wexford. He's about 14 miles away from me. But I had an uncle there, so I knew who the Tóibíns were. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so
it's kind of a small area then.
Yeah, it's a small area.
Well, what town were you in?
I was in Wexford itself, and he's a little town called Enniscorthy. For those of you who've seen Brooklyn, the movie Brooklyn, that's shot in Enniscorthy, which is about 13 miles away from where I live.
You're listening to an interview with Larry Kerwin, lead vocalist for the band Black 47, novelist and music historian, and creator of a new musical, Paradise Square. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
When did you pick up a guitar? Was it a guitar that got you interested in music?
Yeah. like everyone, I realized if you had a guitar, you're going to meet girls. No, it was just, you know, everyone was into the Beatles and into... Wexford was a music town. There's an opera festival there. It's really close to England, to London. So if you were going to emigrate from Wexford, you would go to London rather than to New York.
Did you head over to London at all?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
How long did that take?
You just took a boat across to Fishguard in Wales, and then there's a train waiting. So the whole thing probably takes about 9 hours, something like that. You go drinking in Wexford on a Saturday night, you go to the boat, and you're in London early on Sunday morning.
At a certain point, you figured you'll start playing in the clubs and just jam around with people, huh?
Yeah, in Wexford, too, there was music in the bars. So, you know, I played in little rock bands and everything, and then I met a guy who had a band, and he was the one who introduced me to playing in bars for money and accompanying dockers and whatever, yeah.
Had you done any writing?
Yeah, I wrote some awful songs when I was about 16 or 17. Sure.
Prose writing, though.
Oh, prose writing. I was always interested in writing, and I knew I'd be a writer someday, but music was just much more exciting than sitting down and writing. I didn't really start writing in a big way till I came to the U.S., and there was so many opportunities to write for theater or write novels, and I did both of them.
So what brought you to America?
Adventure. I was about 20 when I first came, and I'd also seen Midnight Cowboy. I thought, I want a piece of that. After being a small town like Wexford, just the idea of New York was just... Well, I was also very political, so I couldn't go to London. I didn't feel like I could go there.
Because of the troubles in the North.
Yeah.
Are you still political?
Yeah. Well, look at the Black 47's output. A lot of it is political. This play is political. I mean, I've always been a political writer of some sort or other.
What is Malachi McCourt's Bells of Hell?
It was one of the most wonderful bars in the world. It was at the top of Greenwich Village on 13th Street and 6th Avenue. And Malachi is a brother of Frank McCourt, who wrote Angela's Ashes. And Frank was one of the customers. He was a school teacher at the time. And it was full of writers like Pete Hamill and rock writers like Lester Bangs and a lot of English and Irish guys and women and a lot of political people, too. I remember seeing John Kerry in there one time when he was in the Vietnam Vets Against the War. So it had a big back room that had political events and also had music events. I played there for many years.
And you were in a band at that point?
I was in a duo called Turner and Kerwin of Wexford. The hardest name ever to say. I was there with my partner and friend Pierce Turner, and we played in the back room of this bar.
Were you playing acoustic with him? Or?
No, we were using an electric acoustic guitar with a lot of effects on it, and he was playing a clavinet and a Moog synthesizer, so we made one unholy noise in there.
At some point, you formed Black 47. That came later, though.
Yes, that came later. I had a record contract with CBS Records with Pierce in a band called the Major Thinkers. We were going to be the next new thing, and then we got dropped by the label, and I decided that now is the time to really concentrate on playwriting. So I gave up music totally for 4 years or something like that and just wrote nonstop and put on everything, directed and produced everything that I did. So I got this great apprenticeship in playwriting.
Where did you produce it?
Oh, just in small theaters around New York. Yeah. There's a vibrant kind of off Broadway scene.
Is that the Liverpool Fantasy?
Yeah, Liverpool Fantasy actually was more off Broadway. That's had a lot of productions. It was about the Beatles if they hadn't made it. And that did really well. And I turned it into a novel that's out there still. But then around 89,
you were listening to KBOO Portland.
K-Boot Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. On the 46th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, this rally is in support and solidarity with all people who have considered, are considering, or have received abortions. It is a protest of the Rally to the Oregon Right to Life March and will celebrate our victories in imagining a future where every person has access to the reproductive health care they want and deserve. Again, that's the Counter Rally for Reproductive Justice on Saturday, January 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square on the southwest corner at Morrison and Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kboot.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The World Arts Foundation and KBOO would like to invite you to the 34th anniversary and tribute to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., entitled We've Come This Far, Keep Alive the Dreams. On Monday, January 21st,